Hey, it's episode 433 of the 343 podcast. Today, we're going to be talking about the center mid position, deconstructing the center mids, the six, the eight, the 10. What are the player profiles supposed to look like according to the gold standard? What the heck is the gold standard anyway? And how do different philosophies view the roles of those three positions? And how does that impact things like, say, youth development? How does that impact as to who makes it to the top level and who doesn't make it to the top level? Very interesting discussion. A lot of lessons to be learned here. I think it'll be very good for coaches. It'll be very good for parents. It'll be very good for media who write articles and produce content surrounding this issue. If we wanted to call it an issue, I think it's certainly an issue here in the United States. So I hope you enjoy this one. Here we go. Speaking of deconstructing player profiles, player positions, if you're a coach, you need to go to 343coaching.com. It is essential that you obviously know deeply, very deeply, what a center mid's role is supposed to be. The six, the eight, the 10, the D mid, the box, and the creative or the classic prototypical creative player. Who should be playing in those positions? How do you train those positions better and better and better, because they are kind of like the engine that makes the whole team run. All the other positions are obviously critically important as well. It's hard to differentiate one from the other, but if you want to zoom in to a deeper level and improve your coaching and get your players to improve substantially and notably, because you know, many a times you think that the players are improving, but you kind of have this little sinking feeling in your gut that it's just not working out. Well, after decades worth of work here in the United States, doing remarkable work, doing pioneering work, my brother Brian Kleiben developed this methodology. And the methodology, he didn't invent it. He kind of adapted it to the American soccer environment from the gold standard overseas, the gold standards in South America, the gold standard during the Pep Guardiola era there in Barcelona. So you get to see him in his element, coaching the actual players in the actual team environment, in the actual competitive environment. There is no scripting of this, folks. No, you get to see the real deal. So you go to 343coaching.com. There are free and premium programs for you there. I would highly recommend, if you've known us for a long period of time, you know what we've accomplished, you should just dive headfirst into the premium program. You won't regret it. Thousands of coaches have gone through this program, and thousands of coaches who joined 10 years ago are still in the program. So one last time, you go to 343coaching.com. And parents, we've taken all of this experience that we've delivered to coaches, that we delivered to the ecosystem here in the United States from a coaching perspective. We've adapted it for you, the parents, to better guide and mentor your sons and daughters, no matter what part of the pipeline they are. Obviously, if your kid is younger, even more influence that you're going to have. If your kid is already 15, 16, 17 years of age, well, look, can you kind of turn the ship left or right? Yeah, but you're kind of trying to turn a Titanic. If your kid is 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 even, now you're kind of like in a speedboat and you can definitely adjust courses. So you go to 343masterclass.com. I'm speaking to the parents now. 343masterclass.com is where you want to go. And lastly, if you're coaching in the 7-versus-7 format, you go to 7v7coaching.com. All right, everybody, I hope you enjoyed this discussion regarding central midfielders. Here we go.
I know you famously said you don't really care that much about soccer, right? You're fighting for freedom, opportunity, meritocracy. But if you allow me, Gary, and allow the audience, I'd like to talk soccer today. Specifically, center mids, Gary. I want to go through the six, the eight, and the 10, do a deep, deep dive on what truly makes a world-class center mid. And it would be great if we can go position by position, just talk about the qualities and maybe some of your idols that you grew up watching or that you think were the best when it comes to playing the six or the eight or the 10. Let's start super simple, Gary, softball question. What is it that truly makes a world-class center mid? In your eyes?
Well, a center mid depends on whether the functions in the system that you want to deploy. So if you're talking about a 4-3-3, then that looks a little bit different than a 4-4-2, and looks a little bit different than a 3-5-2, so on and so forth. But I'll stick with what I presume is your main aim, which is some sort of general quality. And if I can stick that player, if I think that player is great, I could stick them into any system. So I'm going to roll with that. Okay. First, let's maybe talk about the more defensive-minded central midfielder, which classically known as the six when we're talking about a 4-3-3. There's two completely different ways that I could go with this. In one direction, I could look for a complete destroyer, recoverer of the ball, and then a simple connector of passes. And that becomes kind of the fulcrum or the pivot or the stability point for the entire team. So I could go in that direction, which is a six that I would absolutely sign up immediately and build around them. And then 180 degrees apart from that, kind of, and if it's not 180, it's a 160 or a 150 or something on that order, could be like a Sergio Busquets, which is not a destroyer of worlds, is not a huge recoverer of balls, but he is super elite at that other component, which is being the fulcrum of the team and the pivot of the team. And literally, they call it a pivot because it's like a pivot point. So if you imagine this pen right here, and I pinch it, you know, imagine I don't pinch it. You can balance it right there on my finger. That is the pivot. It could tilt left, it could tilt right around the pivot point. And that's what that sort of six actually does. Switches the point of attack, as they like to say here, you know, resets the game, you know, with the goalkeeper, with the center backs, or dishes it to his eight and the 10 so that they can build up the attack. Everything swirls around that person, but Busquets is not a classic destroyer like I mentioned before. So that is maybe where we can start off. And I already mentioned one of the two, which is a Busquets type fitting in there. On the other end of the spectrum, maybe you can have something like a Casemiro there as a six. To mention names, right, that everybody can kind of relate to. So I'll just stick with those two, and we can drill in a little bit deeper there before we move on to the other central mid positions.
Yeah, sounds good. And thank you for clarifying the context there, because I wanted to just keep it simple and just talk in a 4-3-3, right? One of the most common formations that you're going to see in football. So naturally, you would have a holding mid. You'd have an eight that's more kind of box to box, and then the 10. Talk to me about, we're sticking with the six here, yeah? Talk to me about some of the non-negotiable technical qualities that these players need to have. And again, the context is world-class, meaning the highest levels of the game.
Non-negotiables, let's see. Phenomenal first touch is crucial, whether you're the classic destroyer or not. And let's be specific here in the sense that world-class first touch, because you're saying world-class, Benny, world-class first touch really depends on what position you play, because you're going to be receiving different types of balls or encountering different types of balls in the different positions. I don't need my six to have a world-class first touch when he's running full speed and he receives a 40-yard diagonal driven ball. He'll never encounter that situation, you know, like a winger would encounter. And in fact, the sixes I just mentioned would probably suck eggs, you know, if they were given a ball like that. Imagine Busquets or imagine Casemiro running as fast they can up the wing and somebody gives them a driven 40-yard diagonal ball and they have the defender closing down on them. Those two guys, I have a hard time believing. I just know it for a fact. It's going to be hard to prove or disprove that they'll bring it down in the air at full speed and their first touch will be in stride and propelling them forward without interrupting any play. They can do that, Benny. Okay, so I just wanted to clarify that. But a world-class first touch for a six kind of means being able to receive balls on the ground more than anything else at different speeds in different sectors of the field under different types of pressure, and be able to either one touch out of it to your teammate correctly or one touch out of it into space so that you can shake whoever is closing down on you or whoever is draped on your back out of it. Those are kind of non-negotiables, because if you fumble the ball in that area of the field, your team is so screwed, it's over. And if you're going to be the pivot point, the fulcrum of the whole team, you can't F up anything, because it's a turnover and they're down your throats. So that is a absolute non-negotiable. With respect to maybe defensive qualities, a non-negotiable is proper positioning. And that means being able to identify specifically when your team is in possession and you don't have the ball, being properly positioned, not only for retention of possession, but in case you lose the ball, that you guys don't get taken advantage of. And the six, again, the fulcrum, is crucial. You can't be caught out of position. And then out of possession, obviously the six is crucial. You can't be caught out of position. So you need that sort of spatial awareness to be able to know where to be and when. And Busquets had that at such a world-class level, in my estimation, that it made up for his lack of physical qualities and physical attributes, because he would be there first before their faster opponent, because he was just smarter than them on the ball and off the ball. And it's not like Casemiro is fast either. You know, he's actually not fast at all. So he had to have world-class positioning to be in the right place at the right time. So those are the immediate two things that come to mind, Benny, with non-negotiables. Notice, I should remark, I didn't mention anything about tackles or, winning aerial duels. None of that stuff came into the picture.
And is that because you're more thinking of playing in a possession-based system? And so you would highly rate a player of technical ability over like a bone-crunching six holding mid? You would prefer that type of player here?
Yeah, man. If you're trading punches and going back and forth and aerial, you know, long balls here and long balls there, then you kind of need a different type of a six for sure.
Would you say that the six is the most important position within the team, even more so than the 10?
You know, I've thought about this question for so many years, and I can't decide, Benny, because here, I'll answer it this way. I think the entire spinal column is critical. And by that, I mean the goalkeeper, the center back, the D mid, and like the nine, okay, or the striker. If you have a strong spinal column, then you could have certain deficiencies in other areas of the field and your team won't break down defensively. And I know people will take issue with this. I'm doing the best I can. Okay. Everybody's going to say, well, what about this? What about this? Well, guys, then you're asking my team to be perfect and perfection. You know what I mean? You're always going to have deficiencies somewhere, but I'm saying the place that you can't have deficiencies, you have to minimize deficiencies, is that spinal column. Keeper, it's obvious. You have a shitty keeper, you're going to either piss the ball away and trying to build out, or even if you're not trying to build out, you're still pissing the ball away. And obviously shot stopping, whatever, you're just going to lose games. The goalkeeper is crucial. Center back, crucial. He's the orchestrator of the entire network, okay? He's the one who's supposed to be kind of commanding the blob back there. And he's got to win his duels, no question about it. If you don't have that, then you're incredibly fragile. The D-mid, we just described why it's so critical. You don't have a D-mid, a good pivot, a good fulcrum to kind of start play, then what are we even playing? I don't even know how you're going to build without a solid six. I don't know how to build without a solid six. And then a striker, that's self-evident. You need somebody to punch in the goal. So if you're missing that, you're screwed too, Benny. Totally screwed. But if I had a pick, no, okay, so my second phase. So which one of those in the spinal column would I say is the most important? I think now it comes down to who is your best player, right? And then everything gets built out of who is your best player in that column. It could very well be that Fabio Cannavaro, the Italian World Cup winner, people can look him up if it's a little bit beyond their time, center back, solid, you're the captain, you're in control. I don't know if he was the best, but he could definitely be considered the best. You build around him. He's the most important piece. As the six, again, he could be the captain, the most important piece. As the striker, again, he could be the captain. He could be the most important piece. So it depends on who you have, Ben. Sorry for rambling. I don't know if that explains it.
No, it does 100%. I think an analogy that I heard from maybe Brian is like, if you think about a car, if one piece in the car is not working, then the entire machine is going to fall apart, right? But I would consider the six one of the main pieces of the car, because without a player to dictate the tempo and the rhythm and when to push forward, without that, Gary, I think it all falls apart. The era of Pep at Barcelona, when they had that midfield trio of Busquets, Xavi, Iniesta, yes, they had other players, Messi and Thierry Henry and Puyol, but that midfield trio, Gary, fuck, man. It was one, it was beautiful to watch. But two, also, I think Barca can credit a lot of their success to those three players right there. And for me, Gary, I think the six would be the most important position. That's my take.
No. I wouldn't fight against you if that's your opinion. No problem. I have no problem with saying that.
I know we've talked about this a lot before, and I think the player that you used was maybe Xavi or Iniesta, but you had said if they had grown up in the U.S., right, with the same qualities that they have, they would be overlooked, right? So you take a Busquets who's, like you said, he's not a destroyer. He's not athletic. He's not fast. Busquets doesn't make it in the U.S., does he, Gary? Because we don't value those type of players.
No, and we already hinted at it that I literally told you myself, if we were going to play in a way that you're trading punches with the opponents, just back and forth, high speed balls in the air, back and forth, long balls all over the place, Busquets could be a liability. In fact, he probably is a liability to you. So even I, right, would be like, if that was my perception of how we wanted a player, I'm like, oh, I can't have this guy here. Like, no, no chance. And people take issue many a time with like, Gary, you're on crack, one of the best players to ever have played the game. Of course, if he came up here, he would make it. You're crazy. Or and to that, I say no for the reason we just gave, okay? And others will say, well, yeah, Gary, of course he wouldn't make it because he would be in our trash youth system. And they would, no, that's not what I'm saying at all. I'm saying, imagine Busquets when he was 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, exactly the Busquets with all his skill and all his brain and everything identical to the real thing when he was in Barcelona. If he was just magically teleported and transported here at any of those ages, he's not making it. He's getting cut. He's on the bench. He's invisible, just demolished. It's not happening for you.
And not just him, right? Iniesta, Xavi.
Yeah.
And N'Golo Kante, bro.
Yeah.
Mean as holding mid. Probably wouldn't make it here, dude. He's too tiny.
The reason Busquets, when he was already basically retired, let's be real, when he went to the Miami office of MLS to play there, he did well. He did fine. But why? Because he was surrounded by his cast of friends from Barcelona. And obviously with the Tata Martino and Mascherano and all that, they built the team such that Busquets can actually function. But if you had dropped him into, I don't know, dropped him into LA Galaxy or something, it's going to be a disaster.
I want the audience to look up a clip of Busquets in training. I think the video is called like, "You Can't Press Sergio Busquets." And Gary, it's literally like a clip of him in a rondo. I think it's with the Spanish national team. Very tight space. But every single time that this guy gets the ball, so calm, perfect first touch to exactly where he wants to go. Literally, the guys are coming in, flying at him, and they're not even getting close to him, man. Because of the composure, because of the first touch. I think that truly is what makes a good six, is being able to have that mentality of, hey, when I get the ball, I'm not going to panic. I'm going to be calm. I'm going to be composed. A big thing that I see, and it's misleading to a lot of parents and players and coaches, when younger kids make the jump from 9v9 to, let's say, 11v11, right? Now, all of a sudden, instead of having 2 seconds on the ball, now that they're on a bigger field and they're still small, a center mid will now have 5 or 6 seconds of time and space on the ball, right? And so to the untrained eye or to the player, it's like, wow, this player looks phenomenal. He never loses the ball. Okay, but look at how much time and space he's being awarded. And then as soon as he moves on to the next level, when he's barely getting press, you know, he can't handle it, you know? Yeah. So I think that's another thing, man, is being able to keep composure under press and not panic, lose the ball. That's a massive trait, I think.
Yeah, and you need to be very good technically and tactically before you get good at that under pressure. And the only way you're going to get good enough technically and tactically is if you're in an environment that develops those sorts of qualities again. So if you're on youth teams that aren't training, quote unquote, the right way for that type of player to develop their technique and their tactical understanding and their soccer intelligence, then they're not going to be very good when things get difficult for you. And we've talked about this so many times, Benny, but it's worth repeating. If a player is not working, you know, double or triple the amount of time that they work with their team, if they're not working outside of the team environment on their own, whatever that means, okay, then you're obviously not going to develop technically either. And when you level up to the next competition levels, you're not going to be successful.
Yeah, very triggering. I've told my play every single team that I've had, Gary, I've told all my players, like, if you are only training twice a week and then you have games on the weekends, you're never going to make it. You're never going to make it to the highest levels, man.
Yeah.
And they'll say, oh, yeah, sure, no problem. And I feel bad, too, because there's some players that at the young ages can get away with that, meaning they only train twice a week and they're still the best player on the team. But as they start getting older, the gap starts closing. And then they realize when it's too late, like, man, I should have put in the work when I was 10 or 11 or 12 years old.
Yeah.
Before we move on to the 8 and the 10, my hope is that people listening to this, whether it's a parent or a coach, even a player, they can take this episode and work towards becoming an amazing center mid or a great center mid, right? Or a world-class center mid if you're willing to put in the work. But how would you individually, if you're 6, right? How would you individually train? You're on your own. What would be the best way?
Well, the reality is this is true for every position, but particularly for the 6, because of the types of passes that you need to be, if we're talking technique, right? And in possession, the wall is the best thing ever because the wall, more than anything, is going to return the ball to you on the ground. And you can control the speed with which it comes back at you on the ground. And you can work both feet and hundreds and thousands of repetitions. Thousands, really, every single day without investing that much time. You can get thousands of touches, the correct type of touches as a 6. Again, if you're a winger, you should be doing that too. But more often than not, what makes a world-class winger is, you know, in at speed, being able to control the ball with your first touch or any sort of touch. And you can't get that with the wall. How are you going to get that with wall exercises, running at full speed and practicing receiving or dishing it out? You can't. So the wall has its limitations. But for a 6, the wall is the best. And obviously, you know, go and play your pickup games. And when you go and play your pickup games, I mean, look, I don't want to restrict anybody from, you know, a kid going and saying, man, I play the 6 on my club team. I want to score goals. You know, I'm going to go play the 9 in my indoor matches, you know, with my friends. That's cool. Go and have fun, have a good time. But it's also an opportunity for you to be the 6 there too and keep improving the craft. So just something to keep in mind.
Yeah. And just in terms of the wall, Gary, I think if you can find a wall that has 3 parts, meaning there's a wall in front of you, a wall to your left, and then a wall to your right. So beneficial because then you're able to, like, let's say you hit it forward to the wall. Okay. As the ball's returning to you, you can open your hips, receive with your left foot, play it this way, comes back more so like replicating the actions of what a holding mid would do, right? If a 6 was by himself on the wall and just going straight, like, sure, there's still going to be value in that. But I think if you can, like a handball core, you know what I'm saying? That is, I think, would be really good repetitions for a 6 to be good or a holding mid.
Yeah. Because you're being the pivot. You're pivoting right from one side to the other side. And the third option is having your first touch go forward into the attack. And you can also have your first touch then go backwards. You know, and there's not a wall behind you in the racquetball courts or whatever, but you're kind of simulating, okay, we're resetting, you know, so you pivot and you go back. You know, it's brilliant, Benny.
Yeah. Is it important for a young player who's learning how to be a center mid? Is it important for them to understand every single one of the roles? Or would you say it's better to specialize yourself in one of the positions and master that craft completely?
Like all the answers, it depends. It depends. You know, I'm sure we'll be talking about maybe like the 10 at some point. Well, some players, just because of their biomechanics and their genetics and their inclinations, you are not a creative playmaking dribbler with fast twitch muscles, you know, that can or that can line break in the ways that a 10 can do or unlock the defense with vision, you know, and deception passes and all this sort of stuff, right? Or shoot on goal and be a goal scorer also. So some quote unquote players don't have that in their makeup. And so in that regard, sure, get some exposure, get some feel for playing that position as well. But let's be real. that's not where you're going to be in the future. So the more you can kind of focus on your proclivities, I think the better the chances are that you're going to go far, because you're going to maximize that skill set.
Right. That's a great point. And I mean, again, we've talked about Busquets a lot, but think about Busquets. You would never see Busquets as a 10. So okay. imagine as a kid, right? His coach is like, oh, you know what? I want you to learn every position. So this year you're going to play the 6, next year the 8, following year the 10. I don't think he'd be the same player that he ended up becoming. You know, he mastered his craft right there, bro. He mastered it.
Yeah. And same with, look, I'll bring up, because our audience is American. If you look at Weston McKennie, his coaches don't even know what position he is. People look at it here as a feature, not a bug, right? That he can play any position. He's polyfunctional. I also agree with that to a certain extent. He can play outside back. He can play center back. He could play the 6. He could play the 8. He's not a 10, but you can put him up the field if you like that. You can play him anywhere on the field. Fine. But it's also indicative that his coaches, who have been world-class coaches over his career, look at that player and they're like, yeah, but you're not my best 6. I need my other guy here. Or you're not my best 8. I need my other guy here. You're not my best outside back. Like, he's not the best at any position, but he's good enough in so many positions that he works himself into the team and into the roster because of necessities of the team, right? Imagine you have an injury, or you see an opponent, and the opponent has, you know, certain exploits that you can take advantage of, or you don't want to be exploited in certain sectors of the field, and you're like, okay, McKennie, that's your job today. But it's an interesting thing in the context of our discussion, because he's good at so many of the positions, but he's not like premier world-class at any one of them.
Yeah, he's like the man child on your youth team, where if the goalie's out, you throw him in the goal because you know he's going to perform right there. Oh, your center back's out, this guy will take over the game, no problem.
I never thought about it that way. That's an interesting way to think about it. He's like your prototypical man child that you throw on the field. Yeah, man.
It really is.
Serve a ball into the box. He'll get up above everybody and head it in.
For sure. I guarantee you that's part of Pochettino's plans for the World Cup, bro. Yeah. Target him on every single corner.
Yeah.
I'm sure guarantee you they scored 2 or 3 goals like that, bro.
Yeah.
I like to think of Weston McKennie as like the Timu version of Jude Bellingham, bro.
Jude's an interesting player too, because he as a 6, he's a different type of, obviously that's not his like fixed position or anything. He's more advanced, obviously, but he can absolutely play that pivot position at an incredibly high level, potentially world-class level, but you're wasting his better features by playing him as a 6. So he's not played there.
Yeah. No, I would look at him more as like a hybrid 8-10, because he is kind of box to box. But this guy's a machine too. I mean, physically, athletically, this guy can run, get stuck in for tackles, but also extremely gifted on the ball.
But that's why he would be wasted as a 6, even though he could be like a world-class 6. It's just like your feature set is such that, no, like, you don't go there. You go over here.
Yeah. Talk about the 8. Maybe give us your all-time greatest 8. And the same thing that we did with the 6, right? Non-negotiables of what would make a good 8. I'm sure some of them will overlap and kind of need to be the same. But what are the non-negotiables of a great 8, a world-class 8?
By the way, I should mention for the 6 also, for the old schoolers in our audience, Fernando Redondo. And for the youngins in the audience, they should go look up Redondo. Hey, just incredible, out of this world. 8. So, gosh, because I don't want to spend too much time on all kinds of different players. I'll just say the extremely well-known ones. Obviously, you're asking me for world-class. We picked Busquets. It kind of sucks, but I pick Iniesta again, right? Another Barca player. But there's a reason that Barca team was what it was, you know, probably the best team to ever have been assembled or ever play the game, period. End of story, during those Pep years and when they won the sextuple. So Iniesta. And again, I could go in two directions here with respect to world-class eights that are 180 degrees apart in their feature set. So, I mean, Iniesta, we all know what Iniesta is. Iniesta, again, not a bone-crunching tackler, not a guy that's going to run 20 kilometers a match back and forth, back and forth. Not a guy that's going to win aerial duels. Not all those things that an American would think is a classic eight. Iniesta's not an eight for an American. He's not an eight. He, again, to your point, he would never make it here in the U.S. if he was transplanted. Where do you play that player? Where do you play him? Oh, Gary, he wouldn't. He would die on the vine, disappear. Another in that sort of spirit, but I think he would make it in the U.S. because of his different physical makeup, athletic sort of makeup, is Modric, top of the line. And he does have that sort of engine in the classic view of the eight to go box to box and can get stuck in and can do all those things that Iniesta historically or traditionally or prototypically or stereotypically can't do. Modric can do those things. He's also a lot more direct than Iniesta, right? Iniesta is more of a short range connector, combination play connector. Yes, Modric can do that, but not as much and as well as Iniesta. What Modric has that Iniesta does not have is unlocking defenses with filtered balls through tiny little windows, you know, between defenders and between a million legs. He can find those seams. And at dribbling capacity, Iniesta can dribble, but it's a different type of dribble. It's just that first 3 meter, 5 meter acceleration is different between those two. Iniesta beats you a lot more with body feints and makes you kind of go the wrong way. And then that's how he gets his advantage. Modric does the same, okay, but it's not to that extent. And it doesn't have to be that extent because he can also beat you with that first 3-5 step acceleration that he's got. And then there's the other one. I don't want to say 180 degree, but I think you'll understand what I'm saying, is a Toni Kroos, right? Toni Kroos is definitely not Luka Modric, definitely not Iniesta, definitely a different type of build. And gosh, I don't know how to characterize him. He's not as elusive or as a dribbler as those two, but he is more prototypical than those guys. And from an aerial perspective, obviously he can win in the air. Yeah, and then if I want to go down the less technical soccer intelligence route, I'll pick Weston McKennie because he will run more than any of those guys. And if you're into these sorts of battles where you have to win defensive duels and aerial duels, then that guy is better than those three that I mentioned. But he completely falls on his face when it comes to all these other qualities.
Hey, Gary, I said world-class.
Okay, okay.
I'm shocked that you just mentioned Weston McKennie's name.
No.
And next. Yeah. Next to fucking Luka Modric, Iniesta.
No. I'm trying to paint the
I see what you're saying.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get it. No, it's just funny. Would you consider Zidane kind of an eight? I know he floated as a 10 a lot, but if you watch a lot of his old clips where he's operating on the field, like he will drop back and help defend, and he truly was just all over the field, man. I think for me, Zidane's one of the greatest midfielders of all time.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's not your fault. It's just the way I framed it in my mind when you asked me the question, okay, let's talk 6, 8, and 10 and the characteristics and stuff. Your mind goes directly to different boxes, right? Like this is the box that is a 6, this is the box that is an 8, this is the box that is a 10. Versus Zidane, he kind of doesn't fit neatly in the box that is an 8. And you hinted at it because the way he played, he had a lot more freedom and liberty. Think about like Messi. Nobody's really coaching Messi and nobody's really telling him you must have this tactical discipline to be only within this sector of the field, or be on this side of this blade of grass versus that side of that blade of grass under these scenarios. Like he does whatever the hell he wants. He has complete liberty to operate. And Zidane, look, I looked at it from less sophisticated eye than I have now, obviously, because in Zidane's era, I was 20 years younger, 15 years younger, 25 years younger. So I'm going off a lot of what my thoughts were at the time. And those have come along with me for the ride, but I still think what I'm saying now is true. he had complete liberty to operate as he felt. And so it's hard for me to place him in the eight box.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Do you think that was the coach saying to him, Zidane, do whatever you want on the field, or be operating? No, I'm serious. Operate in whatever spaces you want. Or it was just Zidane's like, no, I have this understanding of the game. I know what the game plan is, but my team needs me right here. So I'm going to drop. Like, I'm just thinking in the coach's mind, like, is he giving him that freedom? When you know a player is world-class like that, should you as a coach come and say, hey, roam wherever you want, my friend?
I don't know. I've never operated at those levels, Benny. I think, so again, I'm just leaning on whatever experience I currently have. So what comes to mind is when we had Efra, right? Efrain Alvarez, all those years from 9 years of age to 16, when he turned professional. Yes, we taught him tactical discipline. Yes, we taught him these are the spaces to like kind of occupy. Yes, we would kind of tell him, hey, press and do the defensive work as well. But at the same time, we wouldn't put him in a box as much. We would let him operate, right? Go forth, my friend. You are the creative one. You are the one who has all this talent to see things developing and executing on things as you see fit. So I'm leaning on those sorts of experiences and then extrapolating to think that it's probably the same when you're managing Real Madrid and Zidane, or Juventus and Zidane, or France and Zidane. It's like you're kind of, you know, forming a structure, but you're also not telling the guy, this is it. These are your limitations. You let him go.
Understood. Before we move on to the 10, last thing on the 8, the big name or the phrase that gets dropped all the time when you hear the 8 is the engine, right? This guy's the engine of the team. He's box to box. How do you think that phrase came to be? Like, the 8 is the engine of the team.
Great. This is a great question, Benny, because it goes to show you the English language media and what it does to the minds of the fans and everybody in the ecosystem here in the United States and in England, because in England, it's very similar. Oh, you're in the engine room. Like, what comes to mind when you think about being in the engine room? Okay. Different people think about different things, but you're thinking
Titanic, bro.
Well, you're thinking different things. So engine room, you know, this is, I think the historical context, the etymology is something like when they invented the locomotive, you know, and you're shoveling coal into the furnace of the locomotive to create the steam and then turn the turbine and that's the engine room, right? And so you're dirty, you got coal, you're inhaling all kinds of toxic fumes, you know, you got your wife beater on, it's all black and disgusting, you know? And you're with your buddies in the engine room and you're basically going to war, right? In there, and it's hard labor, you know, it's not an office job. So that's the engine room, the American media and everybody talks about. And it taints people's views, which filters into their opinions on players and it filters into their coaching, frankly speaking. If you don't know any better, you're a youth coach. Imagine you're transitioning to being a coach 10 years ago, 5 years ago. Tomorrow, you're starting your first gig as a youth coach. This is the terminology and the visualization that you've had, been reading and hearing on broadcasts and stuff. And so you're taking that to the field with your players, right? And then that you're transmitting that sort of stuff to your players. And then you're forming that type of a footballer and you're selecting those types of players and filtering out the other types of players. If you have a little Busquets on your team or an Iniesta, you're like, this is not an engine room guy. He can't handle it. You know what I mean? We need the strong guys here in the engine room. So I forgot your question because you said engine room and my mind said, okay, I need to get this out.
No, I mean, you basically answered it. It was just like, why do you think that the 8 became known as the engine, or like, well, how does this phrase come to be?
Right. Because, okay, perfect. Because in England and here in the US, the way that they view football is trading punches back and forth, uncontrolled chaos, right? And long balls all over the place and second balls. Here comes the long ball, somebody, you know, heads it or something. And then there's a second ball that everybody has to come in like piranhas and try to win the ball, you know, on the second ball. So who do you need there? You need the engine room guys, right? And it happens to be in the middle of the field. And that is what comes to mind when you think about the engine. The engine is in the middle of the vehicle or in the middle of the whole machine.
How do they call it in Argentina or you know?
They don't call it any, I don't know. They don't call it any of this stuff. Silly stuff, man. I don't know.
Okay, so how can you better define the eight, the role of the eight?
Like in Argentina, they have words like, you know, contención. So that would be like your five or your six, you know, your the stability point, right? Then you have volantes. So volante is basically signifying the guys who guide, right? A volante is somebody who guides the aircraft. And so they're kind of the guides of the team. The eight is the guide. The central midfielders are the guides of the team.
So you reject this whole framing of the engine as the...
It's the dumbest thing. I don't even know. Benny, if you want to play like prototypical historical England played, it makes sense. If you want to play like American soccer has historically played, and still to this day, it's still entrenched in the culture here, the dominant culture, I should say, the one that controls the game, the monopoly, then engine room, and that still makes sense.
Yeah. I know you value more the technique over physicality, but in the eight position, you do kind of need to be athletic, no agree? You need to be able to run for days, transition to go and attack, but also to get back in and get home. I would say like probably the eight does the most running on the whole field, no? Box to box, nonstop all game long.
Yeah, I agree, man. Especially in my opinion, especially in modern football. Look, nobody is Pep's Barcelona anymore. You look at like Vitinha on PSG. That motherfucker is running for days.
100%. All right, Gary. The 10, the magician. Give us your I know this is going to be probably the hardest one, but give us your greatest 10 of all time. And we'll do the same thing that we did with the other two spots.
Yeah. Diego Armando Maradona is the best 10 to ever play. We should just stop right there. Podcast over.
Wait. Is Messi better than Maradona?
It's a very difficult question you're asking me, Benny. Usually I have answers to everything. It's very difficult to answer. It's hard to compare for all the classic reasons that everybody has heard about different eras, you know, demanded different things of players. There are stark differences in the sense of leadership. I'm not saying Messi's not a leader. Obviously, he's a leader. You've seen many of the clips, I'm sure. But it's a different type of leadership. And I think from my outsider's perspective that Messi developed that different type of leadership much later in his career versus Maradona. Maradona had charisma and aura that transcended the sport itself. And it's just seeped into politics. It seeped into economics. It seeped into every facet of Argentine and international life. Messi has not transcended to that point in any sense. And then, I don't know, from my recollections also, keep in mind that I was very, very young. I was a little kid in 86, even though I do have some memories of the 1986 World Cup and especially the World Cup final. Maradona would also score different types of goals than Messi, like that are just out of this world goals. Not to say that Messi's goals aren't out of this world, but just different. So have you seen Messi score a goal like Zlatan Ibrahimovic? Remember when Zlatan came to the LA Galaxy and he had a ball on the volley, you know, and it was his first game that he ever played in MLS and he scored that game. I think it was against LAFC. Again, I'm giving people things that they can recollect, right? Well, Maradona scored those sorts of goals, you know, just outrageous things, but Maradona does it, you know, with Napoli in the best league in the world when it was Serie A, and he took Napoli, which was a tiny no-name whatever club in Italy, all the way to the very top of the food chain in Italy. So it's kind of, the equivalent would be like Messi, I don't know, being signed to Levante or something like this. I'm just getting something out of my head. And Levante goes on to win La Liga and be in Champions League and do all these crazy sorts of things. Who knows? Maybe Messi would have been able to do that. Probably. I don't know. It's just different, Ben. And I think Maradona was the typical 10, a 10 through and through. Like, he wasn't a false nine or a striker or a winger or any of these sorts of things where kind of Messi slots in there.
Yeah, understood. An argument that I hear all the time is, oh, well, the game was so much different back then. If you take Maradona and plop him into the current game, he wouldn't survive. Or they say that all the time, too, about like NBA players. Like if you've seen the clips of the NBA back in the days and you see like Larry Bird and the defenders, right? And then they're like, oh, well, if you threw Larry Bird into the NBA today, he would be a shocking player. Do you agree with that sentiment or not at all, Gary? Like, well, you throw Maradona into the game today, is he still going to be the best player in the world?
Well, first off, I think my quick answer is yes. Okay. I kind of feel like Maradona would tear it up even more today than back then. No, I'm serious, dude,
really?
Because back then, and I remember I've seen this game evolve, and I'm glad you brought up the NBA, because the game now is a lot softer than it was back then. Yes, if you look at video from Maradona's time, 82, 86, 90, I would say, 94 even, there did seem to be some more time and space than there is now. But you know what else was very different is ticky-tacky fouls that exist now, those weren't fouls back then. You were able to annihilate your opponent, like body them up and hack them to smithereens. And it's okay. It's fine. You look at people like Paolo Maldini and how he defended back then. Savage animal. And you don't see that nowadays. It's a lot nicer, a lot neater. And you touch a player and it's a foul. And yellow cards are soft now too. And red cards are soft now too. So I feel like if you drop Maradona in today, he'll be like, oh, this is a joke. I'm just going to run by all you fools.
Oh, very true. But it's a good thing that he played when he did. He doesn't play now because Argentina would have one less World Cup, bro. VAR comes back, handball, bro. And drug tested, kicked out of the game for his entire life, bro.
Yeah, all these things are interesting things to think about, because one could also say, oh yeah, but the opponent would end the game with eight players because they'd have, you know, three red cards.
All right, Gary, let's not go too far into the rabbit hole, but what is it that makes a world-class 10? What made, and obviously Maradona's an outrageous outlier, but yeah, even in today's modern game, right? What makes a truly elite world-class 10?
So I think you have to be off the charts on the creativity scale and in the classic sense of creativity, because I think we make a huge mistake, particularly here in the United States, the dominant culture, the dominant demographic that controls the game. When one says creativity, they think about what I'm going to say now, but there's creativity all over the field. A center back can be extremely creative. It's just a different type of creative than a number 10. You know, the center back could be extremely creative with his subtle body feints, you know, that throw the center striker off, you know, offensively or defensively. He could be extremely creative by breaking lines, you know, with a hard pass that's 30 yards on the ground, you know, to the 8 or the 10 that splits all these lines. And the pass was to boot a disguised pass, you know, the center back's looking this way and the ball goes that way. So there's massive amounts of creativity on and off the ball for a center back, with an outside back, with all the positions all across the field. But what everybody thinks about when one says creativity is Ronaldinho, you know what I'm saying? Or Robinho, you know, you do all these bicycles, you know, or these scissors, and you're doing all these body feints and you're dribbling by people and you're megging them and you're doing sombreritos. And that's what they think about with creativity. So yes, that is the special attribute that I ascribe to the 10. They have to be that player, and that it's effective. Yes, you're able to generate a tremendous amount of dangerous offensive actions that lead to goals or to lead to potential goals, and have finishing capability yourself. So I don't know if we need to expand further than that. I think just with the mental picture of what Ronaldinho used to do, that's a 10.
And who would you say right now, currently, is the best 10 in the world?
You know, see, I just had this conversation with somebody and I disagree with them. I agree with what a lot of current managers, and I've been thinking about for the past 10 years, that the 10 has been disappearing. Maybe it's starting to make a little bit of a comeback. It's hard for me to point to somebody, Benny, that is that guy. Maybe you can help me out. You know, this particular person I was talking to, you know, through Vitinha out there. Okay. Yeah, Vitinha is very creative. Yeah, he generates dangerous offensive actions. But you don't think Ronaldinho when you think Vitinha.
Yeah, for sure.
He's a very tidy player, very neat, tidy player. That is dangerous. Don't get me wrong. But it's not Ronaldinho. It's not Neymar. It's not Maradona. It's not Messi.
Right. I think the 10 has changed a lot in the last, I don't know, 20, 30 years. But honestly, Gary, my favorite 10 to watch is Bruno Fernandes. Obviously, he's not the Ronaldinho type, but just insane amount of creativity, the vision that he has, the line-breaking passes that he makes, his ability to dribble out of tight spaces and, you know, break lines like that. For me, he's my favorite 10 to watch.
I agree. He's the closest thing.
Mean ass number 10, Gary.
Yeah, well, Jude Bellingham could also be considered a 10, but you get what I'm saying, right? It's different. It's just different. You know, you can think about Odegaard, right? From Arsenal. You can think about who else?
Would
you consider Cole Palmer from Chelsea like a 10? Okay. Yeah. But it's not the same.
Yeah. No, I don't think it'll ever be the same, dude.
Or maybe these players that I just think about are just once in a generation, but I don't think so. Cause a lot of these players played in the same era. Dino, Zinedine Zidane, Neymar, Roman Riquelme, you know, I don't see many of these guys.
But why do you think it's going away? What do you think it is?
I think those 10s that I just rattled off right now aren't known for their defensive duties and defensive responsibilities. And so in my estimation, I think they might be perceived as defensive liabilities. And so people say, oh, well, Messi, you know, he's a 10. Yeah, but motherfucker, you're talking about the greatest player of all time, for instance, or in that discussion. Like, you structure the team such that he doesn't have to run and have all these defensive responsibilities. You literally build the whole team so he doesn't have to do that, so he can be who he is, an alien, and just destroy you in a random possession.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it evolves over the next 10 years. If you think about that whole generation that you just rattled off, Gary, from the Ronaldinho era, when they were kids, there was no cell phones, right? But not like it is today. There was no iPads and video games on your phone daily. So how did they grow up and how did they spend their childhood? Nonstop, every single day outside, playing with their friends, playing futsal, playing street soccer. And I'm not saying the current generations of players didn't do that, but maybe they had more distractions and spent less time than those players actually did with the ball at their feet. You know, so let's see where it goes in 5-10 years. Because now all the kids coming up right now, like, they were basically born with the iPhone in their hand, bro. It's going to be interesting to see if it continues to get worse over time.
I see where that logic comes from, and you may be right. My mind goes to the possibility that it's not right in the sense that all these players that we just mentioned and all the professional players around the world, imagine, there's countless professional players, okay? But let's just reduce the scope. Let's just say the top 5 leagues or the top 30 clubs in the world, right? Or 50, whatever. Those players played a shit ton of football outside the team environment, Benny. Like outrageous amounts. They didn't get to be Phil Foden by not playing countless hours like you just described, or Jude Bellingham or any of these guys. They did do that. But these creative types aren't, in my estimate, right, the Dinos, they're just not growing on trees. It seems like they used to grow on trees, or at least it seemed like the managers or the clubs or whoever was the gatekeepers to elevate players to the biggest stages were preferring those guys back then versus not as much nowadays. Or the current development pipeline at all these clubs sees these types of players, but the football has changed to the point where maybe they kind of put guardrails on them a little bit more and shape them to not be Neymar. And that's what people here always say. Oh, you're killing the creativity of the player. See, Gary, you just admitted it. No, I'm just trying to come up with potential explanations because they're not around, Ben.
So basically what you're saying is those players back in the day had more freedom to express themselves on the field. And nowadays, maybe the academies or the clubs, they want more specific functions and roles of the players and kind of limit them to a box, right, is what you're saying.
Maybe. Or it may not be at the youth level. Maybe it's at the pro level. The game at the professional level has become a lot more scientific. Okay. It's become a way more tactical than it used to be. If I look at 1990 World Cup or 1986 World Cup or 94 World Cup or the club games back then, I don't think, again, I'm putting a little asterisk here because I was looking at it as a much younger version of myself without having all the experience that I currently have. But I think it's true because when I look back to that era today, it looks like it wasn't as structured at the professional game. They were all playing more pickup soccer at the professional level. There weren't no like Pep Guardiola's telling, no Thierry Henry, this is your responsibility. You are to stay in this channel of the field. And under these circumstances, you are going to make these specific movements and nothing else. That wasn't really happening back there. It was more of a free-for-all, Benny. Or Zlatan Ibrahimovic, when he goes to Barcelona, Zlatan, this is your role. These are your responsibilities. Do it or you don't play.
Now, didn't Luis Enrique say the same thing about Mbappe, right? Like before he came to PSG, this guy could do whatever he wanted, right? He's untouchable on the field. But when, as soon as it comes to PSG and now, okay, you're playing under Luis Enrique, it's like, no, this is exactly what you need to do tactically. And if you don't execute it, then you're coming off the field, basically. The balls that it takes to say that to Mbappe, bro, because most coaches, like if you're coaching an untouchable like that, a Messi or Neymar, Mbappe, right? You let them get away with whatever you want. But Luis Enrique is like, no, fuck that, dude.
And you've seen the clip, right? It was on a specific one-on-one interview with some sort of media outlet. And Luis Enrique is just sitting on a table, you know, being interviewed. And the subject of Mbappe came up, or it wasn't brought up explicitly. He was just giving his projection of what's going to happen next season, right? And the season had just ended and Mbappe was gone. And he's like, yeah, well, last season had a player that, you know, did whatever the hell they wanted and I had no control over the situation, but next season I'm controlling everything, every single action, you know what I'm saying?
Creo que lo voy a mejorar el siguiente año, sin ninguna duda. Porque el hecho de tener un jugador que se movía por donde él quería implica que hay situaciones de juego que yo no controlo. El año que viene las voy a controlar todas. Todas, sin excepción.
And lo and behold, it's brilliant because he goes on to win PSG's first ever Champions League after that, and he's in the final again this year, all without Mbappe. So
yes.
I'm glad you brought up this point because it reinforces my educated opinion that the game has become so incredibly tactical nowadays and players aren't allowed to do whatever the hell that they want at the professional level.
Yeah. Gary, there's so many more layers and concepts that can be discussed when it comes to center. Maybe we might just have to do another episode. But I want to end with this. A lot of parents are probably listening to this, coaches as well. A lot of coaches that, like when a player comes and asks the coach, like, hey, how do I improve my soccer IQ or how do I improve my vision, right? The coach will come back and say, like, oh, yeah, just watch soccer or watch high-level soccer. But I think it's so much more than that. What's the best advice that you can give to a player or parent to enhance their soccer IQ and vision, like by specifically watching the game? Like, what should they be looking for while they're watching?
Benny, this is multiple episodes. I'll tell you off the cuff my reactions, but they're just simple phrases that need explanation, right? And this requires hours and hours of explanation. First off, don't ball watch, okay? If you're ball watching, you're basically doing what fans do, and you're just a fan. And are you going to absorb some lessons and some appreciation for the game and gain some understanding? Yeah, you're going to get some stuff, but it's going to be extremely superficial. Try to train your eye to watch matches on the TV with a wide angle lens. So you're literally watching all the dots on the field with kind of like, and blur out or fuzzy out the ball carrier, right? Like look at everything else so that you can catch what's actually occurring. So that would be one important piece of advice. And the other is position specific. So if you're a player, if you're a parent of a player and they're playing a certain position, you're doing the same thing I just said, but now you're just staring at that guy that's playing your particular position all game long. Those would be my two best pieces of advice.
Perhaps we'll have to do an entire episode on it, like you said, because just in that one phrase, right? Don't ball watch. We could go for 2 hours here on the reasons why.
You know what's crazy is it's important for somebody who knows football quite well to be your mentor while you're watching matches and point out things that are happening when you're not ball watching. Remember, you're not ball. Presuming you're not ball, you're doing exactly what I just told you to do. But you need a good mentor by your side to point out subtle things that you really don't catch on your own, at least not immediately. And so there's watching on TV, and then there's watching in the stadium too. So it's awesome if you actually have a mentor, again, sitting next to you in a stadium and then pointing out all these sorts of things. And you watching the game the same way that I just described as watching on TV. Don't ball watch. The ball is doing this and you're kind of tracking it, but with your peripheral vision, the ball carrier, you're watching everything else.
Yeah. Where do you sit at a game, Gary? Mandatory half field?
As far away from all the humans as possible. I will give up my half field seats, you know, halfway up the stand. If I'm surrounded by humans and I'm rubbing elbows with them, or there's somebody in front of me, and especially here in the United States, somebody in front of me talking about their daughter's prom dress shopping that they're doing, the game's going on, or they get up and they walk around, they got to go get their nachos and hot dog. Get me the fuck out of there. You know, no.
Yeah.
So I will literally go to the very top, the nosebleeds. If there's nobody there, I will go to the furthest ends of the stadium to watch the game in peace.
Yeah. One of the things I remember about going to watch at the Barca game, and I went to Barcelona, everybody was engaged to the game, Gary. Everybody. Even like there was an older couple sitting next to us, probably in their 70s or 80s, fucking glued to the game the entire time. Halftime, talking about the game. What adjustments do we need to make? You know, that is true football culture, bro. Like here you go to any MLS game and it's basically just a one big social event, you know, and there happens to be a game going on the field.
Yeah. Dumbest shit ever. I don't want to go to a Galaxy game and the guy over here is wearing a Raiders jersey and the guy over here is talking about, you know, the NFL playoffs or something. These are not soccer people, man.
Yep. All right, Gary, let's end it there.
Okay.
This is a fun one, man. I'll have to do some more of this, dude. See, I think you do care about soccer a little bit.
Right? I actually don't. I really don't. Sometimes I regret having so much soccer shit clogging my brain. I need to free up some memory in my mind. I want to delete, you know, and put in more important things.
Yep. I guarantee you watch more than 10,000 hours of MLS too. So
probably, man.
You probably lost a lot of brain cells.
Probably. But I also don't want all that time and energy to go in vain. So
true.
We're doing 3-4-3.
All right, brother. I appreciate you.
Okay. Thank you. Well, that's it for today, guys. Thank you for listening. A reminder for coaches, you can get both the free and premium coaching programs at 343coaching.com. Don't let anyone tell you your teams can't win by playing dominant possession-based football while also developing individual players to the highest levels. Nonsense. We've proved it at every single level, and so have hundreds of serious member coaches across the country. Now that we've moved on to the pro level, we're delivering everything we've learned in the program. Don't wait and continue delaying getting on a proven path. And parents, 343masterclass.com is where you want to go to get a working compass for navigating the American soccer landscape with your player. It's pretty bad out there, but let our experience guide you. Lastly, if you're coaching 7v7, we've got you covered there as well. Go to 7v7coaching.com. Until next time, cheers everyone, and keep building.